where do I begin with John Gooden? We've been talking for 15 minutes in podcast format without the recording going. How are you, John? Good to see you in Las Vegas, my friend.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Yeah. I always get giddy thinking about Las Vegas. There's just something about like the Hangover movie.
Yes.
And when my buddies and I were all getting married, it was always destination Las Vegas. So there's still this thing. By the way, it's very not the Hangover movie whenever I visit Vegas nowadays. But you're still hopeful. Uh-huh. So yeah, it's got this mystique about it.
Las Vegas does.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So even though I'm coming over here and I'm, you know, like we always do, just see the four walls of a hotel room mostly, mm-hmm. I'm probably going to get to walk down the strip at some point. And even flying in and seeing like Las Vegas illuminated, yes. It's cool as shit.
Yeah, flying into Vegas at night is fantastic. Do you think the mystique is higher because you're from the UK?
Yeah.
Like it's more so than even somebody from Florida or New York.
I think so. And then you go home and you tell the mums on the school gate or your buddies, you know, and
went
you go, what are you doing next? I'm going to Vegas. I'm like, oh my God, you go to the best places.
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, I do. The Palace Station Casino, no less. I mean, I leave that bit out.
No, of course.
But
you have to.
Of course. Embellish the truth, if you like.
It
but
is
no,
funny.
It is cool.
And then when you live here, and even when we moved back here, my wife went to college here, so we're familiar with the city even before we moved back in 2017. And I remember thinking like, yeah, but I was here in my 20s, and I still will go down to the strip, and I like it. And now like I can't be bothered to go down to the strip, you know? And it's weird. It's
I'm
like
not
this,
there yet.
This piece of you like dies. Well, no, it wouldn't, because if I went to New York City, if I went to London, I would go to Buckingham Palace. I'd be like, here I am. Here I am. I'm ready to see
where
the
you
sights.
Where you at, Queenie? Yeah.
You know?
Well, no, not her now. Kingy. Yeah,
of course. Yeah. King. I know.
He'll rest their soul.
Oh, The Crown. What a show. So, John, I feel like I struggled through the pandemic more so in the when I look at it from a rear view perspective than when I was actually in it. When we were during the pandemic, it's like, okay, this is what it is. I'm not going to let it ruin my day, blah, blah, blah. But as the world like came out of it and I look back on it, I'm just like, gosh, I probably really kind of battled it mentally in a lot of different ways. Some of it self-induced, some of it because of the situations that we were all forced to adapt to. And I always like kept in perspective, I'm just like, nobody in our role as broadcasters or doing what we love to do in this space got the shorter end of the stick than you. Well, how did you handle it?
Yeah.
First, do you agree with it and how do you handle it?
Well, I'm not sure I agree fully on the thick of the pandemic, like mm-hmm. 2020, because mm-hmm. actually when the UFC was forced to go to Fight Island, mm-hmm. I got the nod.
Mm-hmm.
But coming out of the pandemic, like 2021, when the UFC started opening up in some states over here,
yes,
then they were no longer going to Fight Island. I didn't have a visa to come over. I wasn't able to do shoots in Europe because no one was traveling around yet. All the protocols were set in place. So I always bang this drum and I feel like it's a broken record, but I don't know if people realize that a lot of my role is actually producing. I do a lot of producing stuff for the UFC, which means visiting fighters or during fight week, interviewing people. So, but you take that away from me, then not only am I not getting run outs on the broadcast, I'm disconnected from my UFC family.
Exactly. Like,
and as humans, we want to add value. You know, we want to be a part of something. We want to know that we're useful. And of course, we've got to put bread on the table. We've got to turn a coin, as my dad would say. And so that was taken away from me. So the first experiences of Fight Island were fantastic. And I'll shout out John Barry in the digital social team, who's mm-hmm. got a tattoo of Fight Island on his arm.
Yeah.
And I kind of gave him a little shit for that when I first saw it. I'm like, what are you doing? Like getting a tattoo of Fight Island. He's like, dude, you do realize the rest of the world was locked away in their homes while we got to play with fight stuff out in a pretty exotic place.
Yes.
And the first one we had access to a beach, even took out a jet ski a couple times. So that was something very special and it really kept me afloat, because pinning back the curtain, my books were down 60% in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
So I was shaking in the corner. I thought I was gonna lose my house.
Mm.
And because I'm, again, I don't know if people know, but like I'm not a UFC employee, I'm a contractor.
Right.
So, yeah, that put a lot of pressures on. And also, I mean, you understand my personality type. Like, I'm a thinker, an overthinker. So I would be sitting there rather than spending quality time with my family, because that was what a lot of people were doing. I'm sitting there thinking my company is failing. I can't see what's coming up. And then, God forbid, this this job that I've taken so many risks and sacrifices to do, I think it's going to go away. I genuinely thought that the Dan Hooker Paul Felder fight was the final fight that I was going to call at one point. And I thought, what a great one to go out on. Mm-hmm. It was a great experience over in New Zealand as well. But a lot of dark thoughts, you know. It's a real shame. But thankfully, in 2023, visa stuff's been sorted out. And I've had a hell of a run this summer as well. Yeah. So we're back to full power, baby.
Dude, when it rains, it pours. You went to Singapore to do a triathlon. Then our event was there. Then you went back to Paris. Then you went to Sydney.
Yeah.
And now you're here.
Yeah.
And now you're going to come back in October.
I'm back again here. Then I go out to Abu Dhabi before I have a breather.
Yeah.
And it's very different because when I was spending some time, I think the longest I went was 9 months between calling fights.
Yeah, it's tough, man.
It was often like November, and then the next run out would be London around March.
Right.
And you and John and all the rest of the guys and gals do such a good job. When you're rusty, I challenge anyone in their respective roles, take a vacation for 2 weeks, come back. Are you at the same pace?
Mm-hmm.
So then take off 6 months. And this isn't a sympathy thing, by the way. It's just my cognition. And I was just my awareness that the UFC maintains a level. Like, I'm expected to hit that level. I haven't been told that, but it's probably maybe I'll put it on myself. I've got to try and hit those notes out the gates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I got away with it. But then in getting there, a lot of anxiety, you know, anticipation anxiety. And so having a run like this, there's been no room to get worked up about what I am or I'm not doing, what my last call was like compared to what's coming up, how Brendan did the last one and John's done and I've can't let the side down. I haven't had time for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been good. You know, I feel like my blood pressure has probably maintained a pretty decent level for the last month, despite the travel.
It's remarkable what you can do between your own ears.
Oh,
like you said, like the anxiety of just like, I thought this was the last fight. I'm disconnected from the crew. Because that's how I felt too. Because it's funny, like on the meetings the other day, you're like, hey guys, where are we going Saturday after the fight? Like, what about you? And I'm like, I got family in town. And then our producer's just like, I might go to California. And I'm just like, John, welcome to the Apex. It's kind of it's more of an office situation. Yeah. We all go to work, we all go home. But it's crazy how your mind can play tricks. Like even just recently, like if I'll do a rip of like a bunch of Apex shows in a row, I'm just like, gosh, does anybody like me anymore? Like, I don't know. I'm not seeing him. And it's just like, yeah, I'm not seeing them because we're all going home to our families and I don't have a road trip coming up. So like nothing changes. And then it's remarkable how quickly you can like find the flow again. Like Singapore was great. It felt like we missed no time. Even though I hadn't seen you in like a year and a half.
Yeah.
And it's like, cool. We're at breakfast. This is normal now.
Yeah.
And you can get right back into it. You mentioned that you took a lot of risks to become a broadcaster. And I don't exactly know your story, but I just know that you're not a formally trained broadcaster.
No.
Like what is the background of before? Were you an electrician?
Yeah, it goes back before then. So growing up, yeah, I probably won't go back that far. But let's say I did the usual, went to university, got a degree, and then went to the City of London and was working in the financial markets, but on a kind of recruitment side.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be headhunting for banks, if you will, in a technology space. And it wasn't really where I wanted to be. There's a lot of salesy type people.
Was it like, this is what I'm supposed to do as an adult?
A little bit like that.
I had
that.
A friend like that. Like he didn't really like finance, but he majored in finance and then he got a financial job. And then it's, you know.
I wanted to be a stockbroker.
Oh, you did? Okay.
So, yeah, I did. And I felt like getting closer to the city would allow me to show my strength and then I'd finally find a way. But it didn't quite happen like that. I enjoyed my time, but I got really confident when I was over there because I stayed at home when I went to university. I was in love, but that relationship didn't work out when I got fairly confident. Now I'm working in the City of London. And when I was there, because I'm old, everyone was out on like a Thursday night, Friday night, like a Monday night. And it was debauchery. So I was getting noticed and I had a little money in my pocket as well. You could look good. Like I've been wearing these suits for a minute now.
Yeah, yeah.
So with that confidence, I then started looking around at certain job roles and I just saw a few presenters or hosts, as you might call them, back in the UK. I was like, that looks like a really fun job. And I would walk in a room and I could hold a crowd and I'm a little different now. I'm a little bit more reserved than what Johnny G was back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But it gave me this thought that, oh, fuck it, I'll go and do that. And so I jacked in this job, really well paid job in the city. and joined the BBC working for free. I was on a consumer products show, but it was still fun at the time. Anyway, I was doing all of that, and then I realized that I was getting paid $14,500 a year. I'd gone from earning nearly $40,000 a year, living in London, having the time of my life, to now moving back with my parents, earning a very meager salary. And with the positivity and the fun, John, it just went away. They screen tested me for some interesting stuff, but then they scrapped the channel. So it was like, we're going to make you into a producer. And those producers have been around 10 years. They're earning 35K. So I still had this capitalist thing about me. I still wanted to be a high earner, high achiever, but I wanted the cool job as well. And they don't always go hand in hand. So I gave it a go and it didn't work. I went back to the city. The IT bubble burst. So then I left the city, and my dad's always been a workaholic. 7 days a week, own business since, like, he had me when he was 21. So at that time, so I didn't really see a great deal of him. So I think there was this thing about reconnecting with him a little bit. And all of my family are real blue collar, like hard work is the way.
Where are you from?
So they're from London, and now we're just north of London in the home counties, like the suburbs.
Like, but not like a different city in England.
So I grew up in a place near Watford. Okay. So if people follow their football, then they have a Premier League team. So it's a pretty well-known city.
Hold on. Watford, is that where Elton John is from?
That's exact. And I went to the same school.
Yeah,
I did. And George Michael actually grew up a couple of roads away from me. Alison Moyer used to walk the dog with my late mother. We've had some. Well,
Elton John bought the football team.
He did, yeah.
So I read his book and I went on a crazy Elton John. Like, I just listened to nothing but Elton John, and I was learning the piano.
So that's right.
Watford. And I was just like, that is.
It's
north of London. Okay, but it's suburbs. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got some really cool history, and it's it's an interesting place, but it's home for me. So I ended up retraining as an electrician to join my dad's company, and I was all in. Like, I was
mid-20s.
Yeah, it was about mid-20s. Yeah. And but all the while, sports has been a part of my life since I was 5.
Sure.
I was a competitive swimmer. That turned to martial arts. I was like national judo championships when I was 7, 8 years old. Then I saw Karate Kid, changed to karate, did that. Then my neighbor was a boxer and my dad was really into boxing, and Barry McGuigan and like the Chris Eubank era. I was a massive Nassim Hamed fan, switched to boxing. Represented St. Albans, then Hearts, Beds and Bucks. But then none of my friends did any of this. So then football's a big thing back home. I then went back to football. But all the while, fight sports, combat sports is there bubbling away. And whilst I was an electrician, I took Muay Thai, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, MMA. And I was still part of the same team now. I've been at Team Crossface since about 2009, David Lee. And we put on a show, or Dave put on a show, and a woman came down to do like a little backstage reporter thing to cover the event. And bless her, MMA back then, it's not that long ago, but she just had no clue. And she kind of made a bit of a mockery of it.
No clue about the sport.
No clue about the sport. And I didn't like the way that she was kind of talking to the athletes.
These are savages in cages.
Well, it's just a bit sort of jokey, and it's not a joke.
Yeah.
So I didn't really blame her for it, but I turned around to my coach and said, look, you don't know this, but back in the day I harbored some intentions to be a presenter. Like, I could do that. Let me do that. He said, well, I have no hold over the network who's doing that, but what about commentary? And the interesting thing was, when I was at the BBC, they had like an apprenticeship scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But commentators in the UK, they're different to the US. They're not seen. So they never do any rips on camera. They're lip mics. They're typically older, and they sit in the stadium and you just hear their voices. So
for like all sports?
Yeah. I never knew what the commentators looked like growing
for
up.
For like a football game or
anything. Wow. I could recognize their voices.
Of course.
But I didn't know their story, didn't know their thing. And it wasn't the cool job.
Mm-hmm.
So when this was circulated, it kind of piqued my interest. And I thought, no, I want to be a presenter. Because that looks like the traveling around the world bit, delivering information.
You're on camera.
On camera. And it's not the glitz and the glamour and the fame. It just felt more like what I would want to do.
Yeah.
Rather than sit there being, there was like stats guys.
I got you,
A guy called Motson, who is very famous. Anyway, I said no to that. But then when this opportunity came around at MMA, I said yes. So I got a dictaphone. I still own it now. And I just sat there, one-man booth, 20 amateur fights in a night, running around the backstage, guys getting their hands wrapped. Like, dude, there was no Facebook, YouTube stuff really that was popping at the time to stalk people. So that was the information I was getting for the walkouts. And it was a really steep learning curve, but it was great, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's never going to get any harder than that right now.
That's what I always thought when I was coming up. I was like, I'm covering a high school cross-country meet.
Right.
I'm filming the start of the race and the end of the race. And I don't know anything about any of these people, but yeah. I'm going to be forced to talk about it.
Yeah.
What better prep could you have?
You have to get down in the weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, this wasn't even by design that I thought I was doing something particularly special, but I would see a fight card. I'd see five guys from the same team. I'd call up the coach, say, coach, can I come down and train with you? Because remember, this is like amateurs or yeah. early pros. So yeah. that was a similar level to
very
where I
accessible.
Was at.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would then jump on the mats and I would train with the guys that had fights coming up. And then if anyone's trained and they know like the culture of the gyms, you're then sweaty, bloody, sitting down on a mat, just shooting the shit. And mm. that's when you really get to know people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because I jumped in, you're going through it with people, you get a little bit more respect maybe at the time. People will open up to you.
No question about it.
And you're in it. So I think the fact that I did that, it's always stuck with me. And I still stayed in touch with some of the guys from back in the day. And it's very lovely. Mm. I sort of forget that early part of my career, if you... But it wasn't a career at the time.
No, right.
This was just a hobby.
Yeah.
So I got noticed doing that by Graham Boylan, who owns Cage Warriors now. He had his own show. He asked if I was freelance. I didn't even know what that meant. I did a show for him. He then acquired Cage Warriors. He brought me on board. I will always be indebted and grateful to him for that. And I was then doing the Cage Warriors stuff. And we got to a point where, by the way, I was still wanted the whole business thing to work out.
Yeah,
I was now married, let's say.
Right.
And my wife, I'm using all of our holiday time to go cool fights.
Yeah.
I was doing Cage Warriors and a couple of other shows as well. She's not getting a lot out of this, by the way. In and around this time, I got a really bad back injury. A friend of mine died in a kickboxing match. Mm. So my ambitions to turn pro and compete, they kind of went away. A little bit by choice, a little bit taken away from me, which is always a big regret. But then without getting too deep, it would have been very selfish of me to get in the cage and fight soon after one of our guys lost his life in a kickboxing match. It just would have been too difficult for my friendship group. So I then had to put my efforts into some other aspect of the sport. And kind of here we are. I was then jostling, calling fights and the electrical stuff. I got frustrated that there was no opportunities for a cage fighting commentator, as I was told, in the UK. I don't think it's much different now, truth be told, in terms of the opportunities for someone like me if I wasn't with the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
So, I remember doing the O2 Arena and then going to a building site the next day. You know, it was fucking dark, man. I was like, what? I'm meant to be good at this, but I still have to do like drills in the wall.
Collar.
And like, I'm clearly not good at what I do. Because if I was good enough, then the phone would ring and I'd have his opportunity. So I stuck the course.
Yeah.
My wife stuck with me. God bless her. And here we are today.
That's wild, man. The O2 for a Cage Warrior show?
No, the O2 2014.
That was your first for the UFC.
Manuel Gustafsson.
So that was your first UFC, and then you went to work as an electrician the next day.
Yeah. Mate, it was the biggest calm down ever. I'll remember it. I remember walking into the job because it's grey walls. There's no plaster on the walls. It's dusty. It's noisy. No one's happy to be there first thing in the morning. It was, it was pretty bad. And I balanced it for about 18 months because I was doing three to five gigs.
Yeah, you didn't know how much work there was going to be.
It wasn't. Yeah. We had Inside the Octagon, which was helping. And that's when me producing stuff came up.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of fell into that.
And
that
just increased.
Because all I wanted to do was replace the salary. Like, I just want to earn the same amount of money as I was as an electrician, calling fights. I was a little bit short at first, but I thought, let's do it anyway.
You gotta go in.
And let's kind of cut the safety net and see what we can do.
So when I started calling fights for the UFC Contender Series, the first season, 2017, I had just been laid off. I have a very similar story to yours. It's funny. So, and then I called my first show in Fresno, December, Cub Swanson, Brian Ortega. And it was like a tryout, right? Like, they knew they wanted to call me back, but it was kind of like a trial. I was just like, is this guy going to work?
Yeah.
Because Anik was elevated in the first role, but we needed somebody else. And Dan Helly was still with NFL Network. So it was kind of like, how are we going to piece this together? And I was available. And we moved out to Las Vegas. And I said, in 2018, I don't know if I'm going to have 4 shows or 12 shows or more, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so I was all set up to get a job at like a strip mall casino out here as a, like a slot manager. And I called Fresno on a Saturday. And then I was supposed to, on like Tuesday the following week, fly home Sunday. And then on Tuesday of the following week, I was supposed to go to new hire orientation. And I would have been making, you know, not a lot of money to go in a smoky place where people are just pull the slot machine and drink some beers at the bar and play video poker. And instead of being like on TV, you know. And I talked to Zach, our boss, on that Monday. And he was just, and he gave me like a couple more shows, whatever. And I told my wife, I was just like, I think I just got to burn this whole other job, and just like, I think it's gonna be enough, and so we'll go for it.
Yeah,
yeah.
And here you
it's
are.
Kind of funny, but it is crazy because like you can, you know, you'd be here, and then you're like, well, should I keep doing it? And it's like, it's no knock on like how the UFC runs their business. It's just like when you start out,
it's just,
like you said, you have to take the risk a little
bit.
There
weren't that shows around.
And
I remember there were people close to me saying, this is a pipe dream. You need to give it up now.
Because 2014, way different place in terms of the sport. We're not on ESPN.
Nope.
We're on Fox, but it's not big.
And it's certainly not big in the UK.
It's overnight in the UK.
Yeah.
As far as the shows in the States.
Yeah. So it was tough, but my best mate, Willie B, God love him, he talked me down off the ledge. I was in Abbots Langley on a building site going, dude, I can't do this to everyone anymore. I'm just going to fucking, like, say goodbye to this, and I'm just going to, like, do the electrician thing proper and really kick on with the business. And he goes, no, you're so close. You've got to stay with it. You're so close. And actually, people don't know this. Cage Warriors let me go. We got to October. And they were like, I was getting paid £250 to call a Cage Warriors event, but I would do like a podcast for them. I would be writing all the little scripts we were doing, do the weigh-ins, and that's 4 days. As well, it can be 4 days away. £250. I was losing money.
Yeah.
And we got to October, and I called up Graham and said, look, I want to do the show, but I've run out of holiday time. Can you just give me an extra £100? Because that's what I would earn, like on a building site, and I need to take something home to the wife. And he's like, no. He says, I might call you next year. I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Right.
Like, I've been on this journey with you guys since like 2010. It's 2013 now. We're on to something. And you just like, no. And it forced me to pick up the phone to the UFC, and things started moving along internationally. And I got opportunities, and it just started to gather some speed.
That's wild, man. Man, I'm glad I have that story. That's good. Almost 10 years now.
Be my 10-year anniversary, 2024.
Oh, I can't wait. We got to do something special. So I told the story on my podcast that I did in Singapore. I talked to Gilbert Burns, and then I told the funny story about how I'm reading a great book called 4,000 Weeks, and I have it at breakfast, and you're like, what are you reading? And then you look at it, and then you're like, you know what? It's a great book. It's 4,000 Weeks. I'm like, John, that's the book. Like, what are you?
The cover was different.
All this
the
to
new
say,
edition.
Exactly. All this to say, you're a reader, and like you said, you're a thinker and whatever. And it's like, when did that happen and why did that happen, where you get into kind of like personal development, self-improvement, nonfiction? Because I am very much into that, but I wasn't a reader at all, like until I was like 33 years old or something. What is that journey for you of like, I want to get better and I want to actively work on it?
I think it's MMA, you know. I think it's being a martial artist. I really do. Like, I approach everything as training and upskilling. So one thing that I struggled with the commentary, and still do to a certain extent until this year, really, because I've had a lot of outings. But if I approach everything like a martial artist, I have to get to the gym twice a week to maintain. I have to get 3 times if I want to improve. Right. So I've got to be working the muscle.
It's like a ledger.
Yeah. Like, otherwise you're just going backwards, right? Mm-hmm. Well, where's the training for commentary? Like, I'm not picking up a mic in any other sport, or, you know, the UFC have locked me in, quite rightfully. There's reasons for it as well, so I can't work other shows,
right?
Or don't work other shows. And I've put myself in the fire a few times in the last few years, and I can see why they do that. But then I feel uncomfortable with that. Like, how can I train commentary? And it's not the same sitting there on fight night, especially in the UK, because it starts at midnight for us. So you're going to get the worst version of me trying to be you, mute you down, and then just, and no one's going to sit by my side.
To me, it never works to do that unless you're like in college and you're like just trying to figure out the flow of the game. But once you're a proper broadcaster, like I never turn down the volume and call along. It's a good idea in theory.
Yeah.
And it works if you're 20. Yeah, just to like try to figure out your voice, but then it doesn't, it's, it's tough to practice.
Yeah. So then there's all these other things. And as I say, because much like you, you know, it wasn't like this seamless jump from full-time gig, decent amount of money, full-time gig, still got a decent amount of money. There's all of these ups and downs. And that's what makes, it's never going to be easy. I've realized this over my years, you know, and it shouldn't be. If it was easy, it's not worth doing. There's no shortcuts. Fuck me, there's no, honestly, I have been through the mill in many different respects, but it, and to sound corny and like every one of these books, it's just repackaging the same shit, but you kind of grow through what you go through, right? And you got to tread the boards from like the very greenest level all the way through, because when you leap even from Cage Warriors to the UFC, and I don't mean, I'm not putting Cage Warriors down, but I've gone from essentially calling fights and a bit of podcasting to, you know this, hundreds of pre-prepared items and scripts to get you in and out of stuff and on to the next thing. The amount of prep and your, you know, your, the draw on vocabulary and verbiage is way different. And with that, you then you've got the attention, right? And I just struggled with a lot of it. You know, like, I got death threats when I first came through. Like,
what?
Who's this guy? Yeah. The funniest one was, I wish your mum would have swallowed. I thought that was funny.
Hold on, what? Oh, your mum?
Yeah. That was a good one, right?
What?
My wife, we laugh about it now. My wife actually sent me a Valentine's card with that on it a few years ago. Bless her.
Was it a tweet?
Yeah, yeah. Twitter was bad back in the day. Bowtie bellend, bowtie wanker. Like,
Holy smokes.
Yeah, it was really, it was rough because I wasn't used to it.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't been given the chance to grow the skin, the hard skin, you know, the armory that we have to have now.
I can't believe somebody tweeted that.
I'm just like this innocent martial arts enthusiast. That's
not a professionally trained broadcaster.
No.
That's trying to make a go of it.
But I'm one of you as well. This is what was upsetting.
Right, you're a fan.
Because I was a fan and I'm part of the community.
Yeah. Did that make you understand it a little bit better though? Because you'd be like, gosh, if somebody came on and they weren't very good at something that's important to me.
Yes.
That helped me a little bit. And that, because I grew up a hockey fan, and so you can spot fakes.
Yes.
And then even if there's somebody that's not a fake, but they just don't do it the way that you like it, you're just like, gosh, I love this so much. Stop ruining it.
Yes.
Even though that person loves what you love the same.
Yeah. And I
understood
it.
It doesn't excuse it.
Well, I just thought that I did know what, and I do know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
I know it inside out, like from the, I've never walked the boards. I've never like done world titles or any of that kind of stuff, but I've been around it like a long time now. So even back then when I joined the UFC, I'd seen a lot of stuff in the sport. So it was my happy place. So now you're like, I'm like, what is going on? And then I thought that, because of that, I was getting that abuse. I thought that the UFC were only going to read that, and I thought my career was done.
Right,
and I'm like, it's all over.
Yeah.
So it's like I've done all of this. I've made all this sacrifice. My wife stayed with me. We've missed out on everything. I don't go to birthdays. I don't go to christenings, weddings, funerals, bachelor parties, stag do's, whatever you want to call it. I miss them all, you know, and had been for a number of years, even before the UFC. And then you're like, what was all of this for? So then I work on what I can, work on myself, like how do I deal with this? And what else can I be doing to bridge the gap financially? What else can I be doing in my relationships? And, you know, a lot of guilt came with leaving my dad's company because a lot of it was built around my skill set. I was the kind of regulatory guy. I was the guy that was au fait with all the technology. And my dad's, you know, he's at retirement age now. Mm-hmm. And to ask him to pick that up was just too much. And and it was hard to find people. So, again, without his flexibility, I wouldn't have been able to see this opportunity through. So there's just a lot of stuff. So you start looking around, right? Mm-hmm. You speak to people or you read the books. And with social media, because I had a lot of time between shows, it just grabs you, right?
Yeah.
And you end up going down rabbit holes. And self-improvement's not a bad thing. Although I've gotten a little tired of it. I feel like it's very samey. Yep, but then
I hear you.
But then we get into different parts of our lives, which is why the 4,000 weeks thing resonated. Mm-hmm. So there's that Die With Zero is the other one I told you. Yeah, there's a good follow-up. Yeah. Just because now I'm starting to get some kind of foundation financially. It's like I need to make this work. Sure. Right.
Yeah.
So having that kind of education as well. So it's all a journey.
Dude, 4,000 weeks. It's one of those books. I'm like 140 pages in. And it's like I find myself kind of holding back on reading it more subconsciously because I don't want it to end. It's right. Like 260 pages, and I'm just like, I'm going to be sad when this is over. I wish this book was 10,000 pages long.
Yeah.
And I pick it up, whether I read it for 5 minutes or 15 minutes, I'm just like, it's like a new perspective that's like crazy. I love that book.
Yeah, I like that. There's another book that is a very different one. Oh, fuck. It's like Fast Lane to Millionaire. Because you know there's a lot of schemes out there.
Yeah, of course.
You know, you've got to be an FX trader, you've got to do this, got to do that. There's a book that this guy wrote. I'll send you the link to it because it's just interesting. And it kind of debunks everything. And just tells you where the real money's at. Mm. And if you want to earn the real money, this is the kind of stuff you want to do. And by the way, it's always boring shit.
Right.
It's the platform. It's the Amazon. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So unless you want to do that, then all this other sexy stuff is just BS.
Yeah.
Just don't waste your time. And it was good to, again, have something packaged in a way that just affirmed what I thought, but I'd still get seduced by the idea of... Back in, you know, 5 years ago, a little crypto stuff might take the edge off here and get a vacation at the end of the year. But it's just honest hard work.
You're always hoping to be on the right side of a bubble for once.
Yep.
And you're just like, everybody else is on the right side of this bubble. Why can't I be on the right side of a bubble for once? And chances are not a lot of people are on the right side of that.
It's all about compounding in everything we do. Particularly with financial stuff, just compounding as little or as much as you can. And that goes the same for your jiu-jitsu journey. Consistency is key. Keep topping it up and doubling down and you'll get there.
What is the theme or book or overarching thought that has stuck with you above many others? Because I have one. Jim Rohn has a quote. He says, success is not something you pursue. It's something you attract by the person you become. And I was just like, man, in like 20 words, that kind of really defines it. Like to go get something, you got to be that first.
Yeah.
And like, it's not like, oh, why is nothing working out for me? I'm chasing this and I'm chasing this. It's just like, if you work on yourself first in whatever aspect is important to you, things will come to you.
There's probably three little ones. I'm so bad at remembering that kind of stuff, but work hard and don't be a dick.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. I like that.
Like, it's real simple. Mm-hmm. All I've ever done is work really fucking hard in everything I do. And I wouldn't want it any other way. I don't feel prepared unless I've probably flogged myself. I'm a little kinder to myself these days. And also, don't be a dick. And I'd like to think that I can, hand on heart, say that I'd like to think, I don't know. We all have our days as well, though, because we're in a high pressure environment. I've had it before where I think I was in Russia. And my notes hadn't, I hadn't been out to the octagon and we're 2 minutes away from the first walk and I've got no notes on the desk.
Right.
And I am freaking the fuck out. I'm like, what? Where are my notes? And I wasn't screaming and shouting at people, but in that moment, probably not the best John Gooden you're ever going to get. So there may have been some points, but I will always apologize to people and I'll make an effort. And I look around and see over the years how people have treated others and their self-awareness is shocking. And you think there's a reason why that's going to follow you around or you're not going to get the opportunity or whatever it might be, or why I got the opportunity and that person didn't. Because I can't justify it in quality. I can only think maybe it's because I've just been a little bit easier to hang around. So there's that. Then one thing that came through a few years ago, when you think you're under the cosh a little bit, like pressure is a privilege. Like, especially with what we do, right? Mm-hmm. It can get gnarly. Like, I've got to organize.
I was going to ask you that. Do you feel a lot of pressure? Because some people, I don't know if I'm doing it wrong. I never feel that much pressure.
Good for you. No, that is a blessing.
And I'm also glad to hear that you take less pressure on yourself these days, because I've been around you sometimes when I'm doing the desk.
Yeah.
Like in New Zealand, I remember, and I'm just like, John. I'm like, you're going to do great, man. You've been doing this for a long time. Chill out. I didn't say that to you, but I can just see your tension on the way to the show.
And I kind of have to apologize for that, because it's not good to have that person in the room. So there is an awareness, because it's an energy, right? But it's not an energy in a bad way. It comes from a good place.
Mm-hmm. I know that.
I really want to represent
That's what I mean. I know.
Myself and everyone very well. And I always feel like you can never do enough prep. But I'm learning. It's taken a long time, though. Do you know what I mean? I'm learning the best ways to go through it. But then I also do like these features shoots, right? Yeah. So I've got one coming up.
Right.
And you go on a plane with a crew, and you're working with sometimes some interesting characters who are cameramen. They're creative types, and they are a certain way, some of them. And you're trying to make, you're a team leader at this point. You're trying to make everything right for them, but you've also got the athlete, and I'm sympathetic to them. But then you've got the UFC that have paid for all of this, and you've got to go back with the goods. And that's a big pressure. I find that is more...
That is something that I don't deal with. So there's an answer right there.
Yeah.
If I go do a feature shoot, like I think I'm supposed to interview Brendan Allen, I'm going to show up, and like when we're in the States, we have crews that we use.
So
I'm going to show up, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to talk to Brendan Allen, and then that's that.
Yeah. Well, this is the
Much
thing.
Much different if you're the head of it.
Well, so you're doing that. So I did this with all the guys that if ever you've seen one of my sit-downs.
Yeah, Tom Aspinall.
Right. So whatever. I will find the location. Uh-huh. I will clear the location. I will go there with the camera crew. I will look at the shots. I'll help them. I'll physically.
Yeah, that's much more involved.
Yeah. I'll physically bring the sticks in, the camera equipment. We'll sit there, look at it. And that's before I've changed or looked at my notes about what I'm going to ask the athlete.
Right.
And then we're also probably shooting a main event feature at the same time.
Exactly.
So I'm balancing, if we spend too long on this, then we won't get that. So it's project management.
Yes.
And I'm aware, and I wouldn't want it any other way, but I know that you, John, and Megan will be sat there, and I don't get hair and makeup on those things or anything like that. Someone will probably be looking after you. Then you walk on and you only have to do your thing.
I don't ask for hair and makeup. I don't get hair and makeup. Okay, but I see what you're saying. I go there with the intent to interview an athlete.
Yeah.
That's about where it ends.
Yeah. But then, the other thing is, all of that you've just done ends up on a drive, mm-hmm. a hard drive. Mm-hmm. You've got tens of thousands of dollars on a hard drive. And just the anxiety that someone's going to spill a drink, the drive's going to go faulty, you duplicate it as well. But until I hand it over and it's been uploaded, I'm like, God, this is like so stressful. And then you've maybe had an issue on the shoot with a member of the team, or someone's not, like, it's a lot. And then you've got to go call fights the next week.
Right, right, right.
So it's, you know, it's an interesting balance.
So there is pressure.
There's,
but I understand it.
But it's a privilege
more.
To be there.
I remember sitting on the desk at ESPNU once, and I'm hosting some like cut-ins for a halftime show, some highlights, stuff like that on the desk. And producer's talking to me. He's just like, yeah, I understand. I mean, you have a high-stress job. You have a high-pressure job, whatever. I'm just like, I'm not stressed. I don't feel pressure. I'm up here talking about sports.
Yeah.
Can't we all have fun with this?
Yeah.
And it's different things for different people. I've just always felt that way. And but again, there's different scenarios. In that case, I'm not producing on in the control room. It's much high pressure and high stress because they got to have a whole circus full of a symphony of things that they have to get right. And my job is to put it into words.
Yeah.
It's really only it's a small piece of the whole puzzle. But when you're leading a project like that, there's a lot.
Yeah. And the other thing that I tell myself is, you get to do this.
Yes. That's where I usually start.
Yeah. So I'm there. I'm in my office at home, the comforts of my home. It's a nice office now as well. And I sit there, and we all have our gripes about our respective jobs, right? I'm sure you've had to rewrite your deck of, you know, prelim or main event, main mm-hmm. cards, like a bunch of times. And it's like, fuck, man, I've done all that work and I've got to redo all of this. But you get to do it, John. Mm-hmm. Like 2013, when you were in limbo, this was a fucking dream.
Mm-hmm.
Now you get to have this problem. So it's just, it's a realization, like the whole gratitude thing. I hate to kind of, say
it is.
That,
like you say, I'm starting to hit a point on the books where I'm just like, I should read some fiction books for a few years.
And it is good to, I actually did that.
Yeah.
I actually started to read some fiction again. Yeah. So my wife's like, you work yourself up as well.
I know.
Because it gets you fired up. It's not nighttime reading sometimes, because my mind starts
that's
going.
That's what I started doing at night. I've started reading fiction or unserious things or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't want to learn something and then sit on it and then have all these ideas like, oh, Cal Newport has this strategy for productivity and blah, blah, you know. It's like, no, just let it freaking go, man. Read some Harry Potter. That's what I've started
doing. Oh, good for you. I live very near the Harry Potter studios.
I read the first book and I remember thinking, like, this is kid stuff, but I'm like, it's pretty well laid out in terms of the story. I see why it's popular. And now I'm on the second book, but it's like, I read like 2 pages every, you know, 2 weeks. Like, it's not like I'm ripping through it, but it's, you know.
Yeah, when you become an addict and you have to go to the studios, it's in Watford, WD.
Well, there we go. I got to go see Elton John's piano at the train station that's up in North London, too. All right, last thing, John. A recent occurrence that has changed your perspective can be the smallest thing. What did you last think about where you just thought about life because it just forced you to? I mean, it could have happened this morning.
Yeah, nothing significant happened this morning, I'm afraid. So what was... It's a lot of the same kind of themes that come up, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I've just got a way more healthy appreciation for like my wife and everything that she does for me. Like things have been rough over the last, you know, well, since Elodie came around, you know, she's been through it, bless her. My daughter had open heart surgery at a year old, and we've got, you know, complicated family stuff, and my mum passed away, but she was troubled before that, and now, bless her, my mother-in-law has got an aggressive palsy, which is like an Alzheimer's and Parkinson's blend, so she's in palliative care right now. So then my father-in-law's life has changed. My dad he's got a new life now, and it's all so quick, and you just sit there, but the one person that's gone through it all and just picks up the pieces and keeps our unit together whilst I travel around the world is my wife. So every time something challenging comes up, I go back to that, and I look at how grateful I am, because she could have walked away. It's not been all, you know, sweetly smelling roses. With our work, it does put a lot of strain on, and I don't know if you try and seek counsel from people in our position, you leave. I know that this is a sore point for you, but when you're on the road a lot, you know, you're essentially walking away from the family unit.
So then,
you know, that having that appreciation, and as you mature, you start seeing these things for what they really are, and the sense of community and your circle. So yeah, it's that I come back to that a lot these days, and I just trying to express to my wife how very, you know, grateful and privileged I am, and that we've got a good thing going on now, and things seem to be getting better, and I seem to be able to handle shit a little bit better as a result as well. So you know,
double thumbs up.
Yeah.
Work hard, don't be a dick, John.
Don't be a dick. And just work hard.
What a great chat we just had.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it. I was thinking to go along the lines of you just kind of paying homage to your wife, and I don't know if I said that word right, being grateful for your wife and all her roles and stuff. It's like I've realized this past summer, like, this is all going to go away when we go decades down the line.
Yep.
And it's going to mean like zero, right? But it seems so important. Like on fight night, it seems so important. And it is in one respect. And then, so I've talked to you about Chris Hemsworth's series on Disney Plus, Limitless, which is just like the best thing I've ever seen. And I just watched the last episode, and I'm just thinking, like, he checks into this retirement thing, and the guy's just like, oh, I understand you did a bit of acting. Like, for those who don't know, they aged him 50 years and they put him in a retirement home, and they tried to equal what his life is going to be like when he's in his 80s. And the person and the actors were like the ones who worked at this retirement community, and they didn't break character at all. And so they sent him to his room, and he had like some old pictures, and he's like, oh, I understand you did a bit of acting. Oh, like, you know, some community theater and stuff like that, whatever. And it's just like Chris Hemsworth, right?
Yeah.
Worldwide superstar, superhero, whatever. And when he's in his 80s, should he get there? It's like, that's the reaction you're going to get from people. Like, when we're older, it's be like, oh, you're on TV? That's cool.
Well,
move on.
I know that we're winding this up, but you might have a better memory of this than I, but I'll ask you a few questions. What was your grandfather's name, and what was his occupation?
I don't know what his occupation was. My dad's grandfather's name was John, and
there you go.
From Dorchester, right? And then my mom's And he died when I was like two or three, so I never really knew him. And then my mom's dad died when I was seven. He was like a mill worker.
And their parents, mm-hmm. do you know what their names
none,
were?
None. I was thinking that
it's
today.
It's not that many generations, no, you know? So the shit that we care about so deeply, I mean, yeah. it feels bad to say it, but they're not going to fucking know who we are or what we did.
So think about this. Jimmy Buffett, right? Just died like within the last month or whatever it was. Jimmy Buffett, Margaritaville, worldwide icon for that lifestyle and his music and whatever. And he's going to get to a point like he gives a burst because he passed away. Everybody's going to listen to his music for a weekend, right? The same thing happened with like Prince and Tom Petty. Everybody takes it as an excuse. I'm going to listen. We got to listen, you know, great. And then it goes a year down the line. It's just like, oh, yeah, Jimmy Buffett died, whatever. And then it goes like two or three years down the line and you hear one of their songs and you just go, didn't he die? It's like, yeah, I think he did die. Didn't he die? And then you look it up on Google and just go, yep, he died. He died in 2023. Oh, yeah, I remember that. And then you just move on with your day.
Yep.
And that's fucking Jimmy Buffett.
Yep.
Or Prince or whoever else. So keep it in perspective, people. John, absolutely. Very special chat. I'm happy to work with you this weekend.
Yeah, will be a fun one. It's a good card.
It's a great one.
Good card.
And I'm not going to be a dick, and I'm going to continue to work hard.
Attaboy.